me pones un ejemplo. Entonces, si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk, real people, real stories. The He's Just Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Today, we meet Dr. Bobby Hoffman, an associate professor at the University of Central Florida, who specializes in motivation science and solving the mysteries of human behavior. At UCF, he teaches a variety of graduate level courses in motivation, learning, cognition, and intelligence. Dr. Hoffman has authored over 100 publications in the field of education, psychology, leadership, and organizational development, and serves on 6 journal editorial boards. He holds a BA in psychology and an MA in human resource psychology. Before earning his PhD, Dr. Hoffman worked over 20 years in HR management and performance and consulting for some of the world's most successful companies, including GE, NBC, KPMG, and the NBA. He is a regular contributor to the Psychology Today website, where his blog, Motivate, has been viewed over 1.2 million times. Dr. Hoffman is the author of 4 previous books, including Hack Your Motivation and Motivation for Learning and Performance. Today, we talk to Dr. Hoffman about his new book, The Paradox of Passion, How Rewards Covertly Control Motivation. We walk with Dr. Hoffman to explore how we can reframe our motivation, not just as a drive for rewards, but as a tool that helps us navigate life's pathways to help guide us towards the outcomes we need and the goals we truly want. Dr. Hoffman, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Jules. I'm excited just hearing about your background and your style. I think we have a lot of information to share with the audience today.
We are truly blessed to have you here today. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit how you got involved into this work. Tell us a little bit about your journey and your walk.
Well, that started when I was very young. I was always inquisitive growing up. I actually, and I haven't shared this on any other show, I used to be called BM when I was a little child. And BM can stand for a lot of different things, but in this case, it stood for Big Mouth. So that's kind of how I got my start in the communications kind of business. But I wound up working in a photo lab way back in the 70s. And I was just amazed at how the people in leadership roles treated people like me who were doing production work, finishing photos and developing photos and stuff. And I just couldn't understand why they treated people the way they did and why they had so many rules and regulations that seemed to make no sense. And that triggered the spark for me to study the motivation of people and leadership. And I went on to get a graduate degree in human resources psychology. And that theme of trying to understand why people are doing what they're doing continued with me through my entire educational and vocational career. So I did a lot of training and development in the corporate roles in the alphabet soup that you described for some major employers, and really focused on personal development, because when you're in a large corporation, Your job is really, as a leader, if you think about it, is not what you accomplish, but what other people accomplish under your direction and tutelage. So this learning and development motivation theme just continued to perpetuate, and it grew into a consulting career for me. And eventually I decided to learn the other side, my motivation was to create a better lifestyle. So I decided to quit my job and I went back to school in 2002 to get my degree in educational psychology. And I've really studied and researched motivation since then. And that's when I've done all my writing. So it's been a long stretched out career with the same underlying things, ultimately to make people's lives better. And that's really the real message behind the current book.
Mm. Again, we're lucky to have you here today, Dr. Hoffman. And let's talk a little bit about motivation, because most of us connect it with what am I going to get out of this? What is this going to drive me to do what? Tell us a right. little bit about what is it that we get wrong when it comes to motivation? And what is the myth that you are trying to look to bust?
Well, there's so many myths and when it comes to motivation, because if you really think about it, everyone talks about motivation. We kind of have a general idea of what we think it is. But when we look at the research, we find a number of things. First, there's the major misconception of people are not motivated. We hear that all the time, especially when we talk about our coworkers or our siblings or partners, children, all the time. We hear that. But that is one of the greatest fallacies, because people are always motivated unless you're dead. You always have an urge to accomplish something, whether that be to grab a cheeseburger, lie on the couch, or research the ultimate cure to a disease like cancer. So typically, we tend to put ourselves in this position where we don't understand the motivation of others because it's not like our own. So we have this conflict. And that really triggers the next misconception about motivation. And that is, we actually know what our own motivation is. So we've got this whole paradigm, this situation where people don't exactly understand or are even aware of their own motivations. It's not necessarily understanding. Once you experience my motivation course or read one of my books, you say, oh yeah, that's right, but I never looked at it like that. So the misconception is thinking that you're motivated in one way, but actually being motivated in a completely different way, because you haven't been given the clues to help you assess the situation. It's almost like, you know, your car is broken down, you look at the car and you say it's not working, and you say, well, you know, it must be the engine. It won't start. But that's typically not what the problem actually is. So it's very kind of hard to identify, and it's below the surface. But here's the thing. In today's culture, we are told repeatedly and through a variety of mechanisms, mostly through the media and through books, that we should be motivated by our passion. And you know what? If you can be motivated by passion alone, you're a very unique individual, because passion is almost like a mythical concept. It's something we strive for, but due to the ups and downs, the highs and lows of motivation, we're always going to get derailed, and that passion is not sustainable over time. So although we're told to love what we do, and we are told you should find your passion and purpose, and if I identified my research competitors or my authorship competitors, they're all talking about drive and passion and never giving up and seeking your goal. And it's really a mythical situation when we look at the research behind it, as well as the philosophy. But nowadays it sounds really good. You should do things because you are, quote, intrinsically motivated, and you're doing things merely for the sheer satisfaction of the experience, without the expectation of any other kind of payoff, like recognition from your friends and family. by people saying to you, you know, Jules, it's a great thing that you're honoring your mother. Now, maybe that's not why you started the podcast, but you're still getting that feedback from an external source. So what we believe is 100% unadulterated motivation coming from within is actually being supported and sustained by factors that are external to you. So yes, passion is the trigger sometimes, but passion is not the only way to achieve a gold standard of motivation. And when it comes to our brain, and here's the big secret book, which I probably shouldn't reveal, but I explain it in the book, is your brain doesn't care. Just like your stomach doesn't care, if you're really hungry, you'll eat anything, won't you? Theoretically, at least. You know, you've seen some movies and stuff and people eating bugs and stuff out in the jungle because they have to satisfy their hunger. Brain has a similar kind of component, which is a hunger for motivation and drive, where you want to feel the urge to accomplish something. And you want to be able to invest effort in reaching that goal, whatever, even if it's to lie on the couch, you want to make it happen. But your brain doesn't care. It doesn't care how you reach and satisfy that goal. It just cares that that goal is satisfied. So this is why it's a very complex kind of issue. And one, if most people, if I don't point this stuff out, you never even think about it. You don't think about what does my brain want to satisfy me today? It just happens. I mean, we often recognize when we don't want to get out of bed and we don't want to move. And what do? We're motivated to stay there because the potential rewards that we seek, we can discuss what those are, but the rewards that we seek are not necessarily materialistic things. And a lot of them require a lot of cognitive horsepower and effort. And many times what we do is we default to the easy way out. I mean, if there are two ways to accomplish a goal, what do? Typically, we take the easiest way, right? So all of these factors are, there's not a singular cause to any action that we take. And it can be very complex. But ultimately, all these factors that I just mentioned, our biology, our perception of what motivates us, what we consider to be rewards, our experiences, the social situation we're in, all of these factors interact to determine our personal motivation. So the more we know about it, the better we are in a position to make changes or mediate our behavior if, in fact, we want to change.
Mm, well said. I can say that I learned tons just in listening to your response and how we sometimes look at things to find that end result, to look for that goal, to kind of help us push ourselves, if you will, to feel motivated. Let's talk a little bit about your book. What inspired you to write The Paradox of Passion and why now?
Well, I feel like this is giveaway Bob Hoffman's secrets night, okay? So I'll give you two reasons why I wrote the book and why now, I will tell you. One reason I wrote the book, and this has been the theme of my entire scholarly existence. I've got a lot of really smart colleagues that are much smarter than me and really great researchers, but they research and write in a fashion that the only people that have a benefit from their hard work are their colleagues or their students who are forced to read their work. That's bothered me tremendously over the years. And that's why I've written over 100 articles on psychology today, because I write in a style that's not academic there and people can value the information. And I get the ideas. Some of them come from me, but a lot of them come from what my colleagues write about. And I just kind of make it practical and easier to understand and don't take this PhD approach. So the one theme is to make people's lives easier and to improve their lives. So that's one motivation. But In the world of professorship, you get to go on sabbatical every 6 years. But you need to have a really good project in order to get sabbatical. When you get sabbatical, what they do is they pay you and you don't have to go to work. It's like everybody's dream. So you have to come up with a good project. And I thought this was a really good project because it combines everything in my life. So that's why I did it now. And the main reason that I'm taking the approach is because most motivation research and the advice that follows from it often overlooks how your brain works. And if you think about that, it makes no sense, because every action we take, whether we're willing to admit it or we're aware of it, originates in our minds in terms of satisfying basic physiological needs. Mm-hmm. So that's the motivation. Now, you're probably going to, you know, what are those physiological needs? But we can get to that a little bit later.
No, I truly saw your book in a style that allowed at least the reader, when people get a chance to read this book, and I'm urging people to buy this book, as I will put it up on my website as well, it gives an opportunity for you to take a journey with. You kind of broke it and divided it into three pieces and named these three chapters will be dedicated to history, but you got into the history piece by aligning what you knew, what others talked about, and named it. And then the rewards, if you will, began to unfold in the later chapters, allowing us to then practice with the evidence base. So this is a well sought out book that I know people will be eager to get into, because it speaks to motivation in all areas. It gives us the research, it gives us history, but also how to apply it. And just like you mentioned, what does it mean to us even when we do that?
Yeah. That's so important.
No, and for me, just getting to your title a little bit more, you mentioned rewards, and usually when we talk about the motivations, convertedly control that motivation, and what does that mean, and how did you think about that subtitle as you was writing that?
Well, let me just give you a 60-second background. When we talk about rewards, these days in our culture in North America, in a lot of those cultures, we get vilified for wanting materialistic rewards. Mm. If you're only interested in being rich and powerful, in many aspects of our culture, you get demonized for that, such as the reputation that people like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk have, and that group of people. But in reality, many of us are motivated by a variety of rewards that don't necessarily mean you're taking advantage of other people or you're a narcissistic individual that only cares about yourself, but you may not be motivated by the actual task that you're doing, that you're motivated by the outcome of that task. So it almost kind of relates back to your prior question, why did I write this book and why now? People should not feel bad if they want to have more influence on other people's lives. That's a reward. Mm-hmm. People shouldn't feel like there's something wrong if they want recognition and have people looking up to them and talking to them. People shouldn't feel bad if, in fact, they want to make a better lifestyle for themselves. And I've spoken in one of my textbooks I wrote, I went and spoke to a bunch of celebrities, and almost every one of them were seeking some kind of reward that went beyond the specific task that they were doing. So this whole, we call it a zeitgeist. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but the zeitgeist now is be passionate about what you do. You don't need to make any money. As long as you're passionate, you'll be happy. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I don't know if we're allowed to use bad words on this podcast, but that's a bunch of BS and it's unsustainable. So rewards, and why are they covertly operating? Because people don't think, you know, if they say, like, I want to help other people. Well, would you help other people if no one gave you any recognition for doing that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does it make you feel good when you help other people? It probably does. So what we believe is, well, I just want to help other people. If everybody ignored you when you helped other people, do you think you'd continue to do it more and more and more? Odds are you'd probably do it less. Mm-hmm. So the actual reward and why it's covert is because we don't see it in that light. So the message gets lost. And, you know, I'll tell you, the way that I discovered this was through my students, because I run this program at the University of Central Florida called the Applied Learning Program.
Mm-hmm.
And I teach the class of motivation. And I decided I was going to ask them, and they have to do a survey at the end of the course. You know, is the course any good? You learn anything? Well, I actually asked them, what did you learn? And this was part of the catalyst for writing the book. And they said, the number one most consistent thing that they said, I learned that I was really extrinsically motivated, meaning money, recognition, power, influence, whatever, more so than I was doing things just for the sheer enjoyment of the experience. So they said, I learned I was extrinsically motivated and not intrinsically motivated. And if I hadn't taken this course, I would have never realized that. Mm. So that kind of stuck in the back of my head. And so I did the survey the following semester and the following semester. Everybody's telling me the same thing. And they're all saying, wow, I never really realized this is the way I was motivated. But I am. And there's nothing wrong with it. That's one of the key messages that I'm trying to get across to people. Not only is there nothing wrong with it, but there are times when these rewards, if they're not controlled by external forces, if you decide what the reward is, you meaning you personally, Jules, or anyone listening to this, if you decide what that reward is, that can be far more motivating for you to achieve that reward than any type of mythical passion that you might think that you're supposed to have to reach your goal.
Can you tell us if rewards truly enhance passion? Or do they always risk like undermining it? Like earlier we were talking about, I have this goal on this around passion. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that is a key question. And the one reason that to the reward business, especially in education and in business, have gotten a bad reputation is because of some studies that were done back in the 1970s. And these studies, you know, I could get into the details and the methodology, but your listeners probably don't care. But the takeaway message here about the methodology was really shoddy. And the shoddy methodology and the study design led to the conclusion, and this has a lot of merit, and I'm not saying that there's no such thing as passion, but if you have passion for something and you then subsequently are rewarded for that passion, meaning you get, you know, if you complete this book, are you familiar with that Pizza Hut reading program? Pizza Hut reading program, you know, you read 50 books, we're going to buy you 20 pizzas. Okay, so what are you reading? What are you reading through the books? You don't care about the books. You care about the pizzas. And if we came back to you after you received your pizzas and asked you what the books were about, you would say, I don't remember. There are detrimental consequences of rewards for things that are already interesting and motivating for you. But here's the caveat. In all of these studies where rewards decrease passion, it is because the rewards are not set by the individual. They're externally controlled. So the Pizza Hut program, for example, said you have to read X amount of books before you get Y amount of pizzas. In other words, you read 10 books, you can get a coupon for a free pizza at Pizza Hut. So you have no flexibility there in terms of how the reward is structured. They didn't measure what you learn from the books, which is a pretty big problem, because rewards, if they're externally applied, should be based on actually achieving some performance milestones. Like maybe if they took a test and everybody who received a score of, you know, 75 or higher got the reward, if you didn't. So there's a lot of contingencies to rewards that make them more effective. But the most effective way to administer reward is when you're the person determining it. And I don't know if you're anything like me, your listeners, if they do this themselves. I do this all the time. Like, I say to myself, you have to write a page in your book before you can go on social media and see what your friends are doing, or before you call your partner and say, hey, you want to go out to dinner. So that's a personal contingency, a self-consequating reward. Mm. And those rewards can be highly, highly motivating. And you're doing it just to, you know, sometimes, and I like to be very honest with my students and certainly your listeners. I write books for recognition. I want people to know my ideas. I write because of the outcome. Am I interested in the material? Yeah, of course I am, because I've discussed it my entire life with you and how the trajectory of my interest and motivation developed and was sustained. But ultimately, if nobody was reading my books and I wasn't making an impact on people like I do in my Psychology Today column, I don't know where, like you talk about your podcast being in all these countries and people listening and you don't know how you did that. Well, I don't know how I got 1.2 million readers to my Psychology Today column. But, you know, when I see that number going up, it makes me feel like I'm doing something worthwhile. And it's got nothing to do with my passion for the content. It's because I know I see that number change. And that is very motivating for me.
Mm. So. In your research, Dr. Hoffman, when you were writing this book, what surprised you about how rewards influence human behavior?
Well, I think this is very typical. I've actually talked to my colleagues about this. When you commit to writing a book, it's usually because you think you know a whole lot about what you're writing about. Mm-hmm. Or else, you wouldn't have the, we call it the self-efficacy, the confidence to go ahead and write that book. But what happens during the process of writing a book, and this has happened every time I write, because I wind up learning 50% more than I did when I started, and I thought I already knew most of everything about the topic. So what surprised me most was learning about the various different neuromodulators that are responsible for feelings of satisfaction, contentment, happiness, energy that come through our physiological processes, and seeing how those work. And the most mind-opening aspect of that was learning that the brain doesn't really care where it gets that satisfaction from as long as it gets it. Mm-hmm. And finding out specifically, I don't want to get too technical, because unless you have a background in neuropsychology, you might not know what I'm talking about. But there are multiple pathways in the brain where different parts of the brain are activated when we receive a reward. And those pathways, and I describe them in the book for people with that technical interest, but there's the main reward pathway, and that main reward pathway, when it's activated, it sends dopamine transmission from one part of your brain to another. And most people have a conception of dopamine being the pleasure molecule in the brain. Mm-hmm. That's partially true. It does activate when we're feeling pleasure, but the main trigger for dopamine is when an urge is satisfied, or the process of that urge being satisfied. And when that neuromodulation process happens, when we embark on a task and we're making progress towards that task and reaching task milestones, we get more and more dopamine synthesis above baseline. So I'm starting to get into a little bit of technical stuff, but here's the simple explanation. We can get that dopamine trigger above baseline. We can get it with passion, which is a type of reward, but we also get the same, almost identical neural processes when that reward is financial, recognition, learning new material. All of those things trigger the same dopamine pathway. Mm-hmm. So the biggest takeaway for me was understanding these neurological processes and learning that passion is just another type of reward.
Well said. And for me, the way I understood that was, we all rely on something, salaries, grades, promotions, and, you know, how we balance these motivators with our own internal drive, I think, is where that balance is. But on the other side of this, if you can explain to us, why do some people lose motivation for things that they once loved?
You're reading my mind now, Jules. Okay. First, let's add to what you just said in terms of those motivators. Now, in the ideal world, people are motivated by improving the lives of others, by improving themselves, by doing good things mm-hmm. for themselves and other people, right? But, okay, let's be realistic. Many people spend much of their time and get this reward synthesis and transmission above baseline through things that are not what we really want, because they can be risky or unhealthy, like smoking, like promiscuity, like drugs, like alcohol. Those also trigger that same reward pathway that I just described. So what will happen is people who are unable, and I won't get into the reasons why they're unable, because it gets really complex. It's got to do with your heredity and gene expression and your cultural upbringing. But there are some people, and you know these people, they don't get any satisfaction in life unless it's from eating, drinking, or doing something that's generally not healthy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you ask the question, well, how come things no longer become motivating? Well, it's very simple. And I shouldn't say it's very simple. It's very complicated in here. It's very simple to talk about. But if you think about like your first sexual partner, or the first time you had your favorite food, or the first time you went to on vacation someplace, or even read a book you really like for the first time, it felt so good. But when you go back and do that again, it's not quite as stimulating as it was the first time. And if we do it all the time, I give my girlfriend a lot of credit, because if it was up to me, I might see her every night. But she knows if I see her every night, I'm not going to want to see her every night. So mm-hmm. she's, mm-hmm. she manages my dopamine transmission by not being available 3 or 4 nights out of the week. And it makes for a better relationship, because we get what's called tolerance, and we get satiated by having the same thing over and over and over again. It doesn't get us as much above baseline for dopamine and serotonin as it would if it's spread out. So if you like cheeseburgers and for some reason you can't get one for a week, when you bite into that cheeseburger after being denied for a week, what happens? Mm-hmm. Tastes great, assuming you like cheeseburgers. And the same thing really applies to everything else, that we reach tolerance. And tolerance means you need more of something to get the same reaction that you used to get. So if we apply this to food, there's no surprise we're encountering obesity. if we apply this to substance abuse or alcohol, there's no surprise we encounter addiction. So, and if we apply it to people that want to work a lot, there's no surprise we encounter people who are workaholics. The same neurological processes are happening beneath the surface where the reward takes more. And, you know, one other thing I'd just like to add to this. If you think about the people that are most successful in the world, do they stay in the same job for their entire career?
Mm.
No. Does a politician stay at the local level? No. And why does that happen? Because this thrill of the achievement and the motivation to achieve at the same level over and over and over for your entire career, and this applies to relationships sometimes that get very stale, it's not stimulating. So they move on to something more. They need something more. And I've never had the opportunity to interview Elon, but I would really like to know why he decided to go and help the government when he has so many other things going on. And my guess is he wasn't getting that thrill from doing the mind-blowing things that he does on a regular basis. Needs something more. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the short story of tolerance and being overly satisfied, that it leads us to can be some very obsessive behaviors.
These were the things I found interesting in your book. And again, it was like being back in grad school, being able to apply and look at you were able to include how the studies measure outcomes and how we learn something, a performance task, the process of how we highlight the rewards kind of shape how our motivation becomes competent. And just like in your answer now, how we are starting to learn to say, I already did this. I need something else to challenge me, whether it is I'm stepping out of the box to take risk, or is it something that I said I need to keep reinventing myself to make this happen? So sometimes when we are dealing with mental health, we have a protective layer that we find ourselves saying, this is helpless. If I continue doing the same thing, I get depressed because no one is giving me any more likes the way they did before. So this suggests that even in our schools, the education system has to find ways to change the rewards and what they look like in changing what the outcome may be, whether it is you're going to apply to even a better school after you leave this one. Is it something that you will get a better job? And I think that that's where your book became practical to me, because I started to see how we start to think to design in our minds, whether it's something that we find as passion or is it the end result. So this was what I found to be very interesting in learning about different aspects of motivation that go beyond the reward system. Tell me about what was challenging about what you did to write this book. Were there any challenges, being that you write about motivation in several aspects and several platforms? What was challenging about this book?
Well, first of all, I have to agree with everything that you said. I think you're really summarizing it well. There's a lot of different contingencies to making rewards effective. And most of the time, we don't have the strategies to really know how to structure that and when to take a break and when to regroup. And not everybody has the confidence to take the risk of doing something new and needs coaching and strategies to make that happen. So I found throughout my life, it's not necessarily, and I teach a class in human intelligence, and I tell everybody in that class, we're all about the same. The difference between you and I or me and my next door neighbor is very, very tiny. So it's not necessarily the horsepower we have, but whether or not we're able to generate that motivation to get get things done. So for me, the biggest challenge, and this is more of a kind of an academic challenge, I'm perpetuating a view that is very unpopular. So in order to perpetuate an unpopular view and go against, you know, I'm like the salmon swimming upstream, you have to make a very strong evidence-based argument. So when people criticize you and dispute it, they don't criticize the idea. Let them criticize the evidence. And I started out the book by criticizing the existing evidence on research related to rewards. So for me, the real challenge, and I did think this out in advance, and I certainly recommend to anyone listening that those people who plan and anticipate bad things happening are usually the ones that are most successful, because bad things happen to everyone in every aspect of life, whether it's, you know, you're showing up for the at the airport and your plane's late, or you go and try and start your car and it doesn't start, or you have a flat tire, or you get a parking ticket or whatever. Sooner or later, you're going to get dinged somehow. So if we can anticipate our strategies to these impending peaks and valleys of life and motivation, we're much better off. So I had a very mechanical process, and I figured, well, the best way for me to make a case that the reputation of rewards is so tarnished and inappropriately vilified was to deconstruct the research that people were supporting. And in the world of academia, the citation rules king. So if you publish something and one of your colleagues cites you and says, well, you know, Hoffman wrote blah, blah, blah in 2019, and they use that in their own work, that's a little check mark for your notoriety and reputation. So the more citations you have of your work, theoretically, the better you are as a researcher and writer and scholar. So I figured, well, let me look at all the stuff that's been cited and rip it apart.
Boy, and you did do that, and you did it justice too. I like how you were able not only to cite, but you named where and from, but then you teased in some of your points that kind of brought it home for us who are starting to learn about the topic. Can you tell me a little bit about what strategies can help someone reignite that spark after burnout? You know, being motivated, we always connect ourselves where today I didn't have a good day, I wasn't at my best self. What can we do to kind of spark that motivation after burnout?
You know, that's like the old show, the $100,000 question here. But there are research-based strategies to respond to that. And if we think about the trajectory of life, you know, we come to these low points, and sometimes we call that postpartum depression. Mm-hmm. You get all excited, you have the baby, and what do you get? What happens next? You get depressed. Because how can you exceed that milestone? It's almost impossible. Mm-hmm. Or if we watch a really good movie or read a really good book and it's over, what happens? All of a sudden you get this plummeting feeling inside you. It's like, oh, what am I going to do now? Or if you come to an end of a relationship, how can I ever replace this relationship? So these are the real practical situations that people encounter on a day-to-day basis. So what do you do? Well, you know, when I outline these, I think there's like 70 different strategies in the book. But the first thing is you take a break and you regroup. And you start to figure out, depending on the situation that led up to this feeling of emptiness or despair, anxiety, frustration, self-doubt, all of these things are lingering in our head. Okay, what do I do next? Well, you take this, and it's like, I call it a refractory period, which means you need time to recover. So you listen to some motivational speakers, and we won't get into that that trade, but they say, never give up. Keep going. Don't let any obstacles stop you. Mm-hmm. Exactly the wrong advice from a behavioral perspective and from a brain perspective, because we got to get that dopamine back to baseline, and it takes time to do that. Remember the cheeseburger analogy. Mm-hmm. If you eat cheeseburgers every day, not going to taste that great. Wait a month. It's great. It's no surprise that you go into alcohol recovery programs. What do? They keep you for 30 days. Is that the magic formula? No, but for the most part, it's empirically and researchly justified that that degree of gap will give you this brain reset. But along with that period of abstinence, and what it really does is regulate your neuromodular system. So there are other things that you do along the way. And the most important ones that come out of motivation research, psychology motivation research, is called self-regulation, mm-hmm. where when you're attempting a task, you're planning in advance what that outcome looks like. You are creating an environment that's conducive to your success. And when I say an environment, I mean everything from the chair you're sitting in, the temperature in the room, removing distractions, getting your stuff, materials together, you know, making some sort of plan. And then you, as you're getting involved in whatever it is you're planning to do, you start thinking about, okay, so what's going to go wrong here? And how am I going to respond to it? And you're monitoring your progress along the way. And if it comes to learning, if you're trying to learn something new, you say, what am I not getting? You just don't keep reading. You go back and you use different kind of learning strategies that I describe in the book. Or if you're not focusing because you start thinking about other stuff, you use some of these regrouping strategies to focus on what you're supposed to focus, blocking out the mental intrusions as opposed to the physical intrusions. And then as you go along and you're getting closer to where you want to be, you start reflecting, what am I doing correctly that is leading me to this outcome? Now, lots of times people don't think about these things. Again, it's about creating awareness. And my other book, Hack Your Motivation, is all about these type of awareness strategies and planning strategies. So there are a lot of very specific things that you can do along the way. And a lot of them are neurologically consistent, or all the ones I write about in Passion and Paradox are neurologically consistent, because a lot of times we get told we should use certain approaches that actually conflict with how the brain works. So we want to make sure that we're making the brain, we'll say, satisfied at the same time as we're making personal progress and getting that internal feedback that we generate when things are going good, but also when things are not going according to plan.
I actually enjoyed that piece as I was skimming through your book again. This cognitive behavioral therapy, if you will, these reinforcement strategies that allow us sometimes, even when we're at our lowest, to find ways to find something positive to bring out the best, whether it's going to a support group and having someone help us out, expose ourselves to something that brings us sweat, exercise, something that can help us say, I can do this. Yeah. So that to me was what I really enjoyed about your book, was that within your strategies that you have, you make them really tangible so that the reader gets an opportunity, even though this is such a dense topic, to really reach it in a way that makes sense to them gradually, in a way that you can refresh your mind to motivate yourself. So it was just a treat to read this, and it's really been a treat having this conversation. I know that within your walks as a professor and teaching these courses, there has to be maybe a student or two that has sometimes crossed your mind, even though that the course continues and you're running this program. Is there a student or students that probably stay in your mind to motivate you during a specific time in your life when you're thinking, hey, I'm thinking about this student? What comes to mind when you're motivating yourself about that story, if you could share?
Well, as I mentioned to you earlier, my students have been very instrumental in my own thinking because, and although I am not a fan of politics, back in the Obama administration, he made a really good point. And I don't remember the exact quote, but the essence of the quote was, even people in power and business need other people to make their dreams come true. So I am very grateful to my students who have influenced my thinking. And frankly, the four books that I've written have been motivated, or at least a spark put into my head by my students. And as an educator, it's not content knowledge that you're sharing with your students. They can look that up, especially in the days of artificial intelligence. They don't need me to tell them facts. What they need me for is to tell them how to use these facts and apply it to their lives. So I always think the key to successful scholarship and education is finding out what specifically motivates a particular student. And that's a very wide range. Mm. Some people go to school because they want a title. Some people go because they want a better job. Some people go because their parents forced them. Some people go because they want to master the topic. So I just told you four motivations for taking a course and going to school. I only teach graduate students now. But you can approach each one of those students differently. And each one of those students is going to bring something to the table, experiences and opportunities that I haven't had. What I desire the most is the most diverse kind of classroom I can have. When I say diverse in terms of cultural experiences, because, you know, I'm an old white guy that grew up in New York City. I don't know what it's like to work on a farm. I don't know what it's like to have a privileged background. I was brought up for the most part by a single mother who was making less than $100 a week, you know? So the experiences other people have can make you a much more knowledgeable and empathetic individual. But ultimately, it's about finding the motivation for that student, for their experience. And you know what? Not everybody is interested in knowledge gain. they're really not. They may say they do, and that's part of the dilemma of self-reporting motivation. You never know if you're getting the truth or a line of BS. That's why physiological measures are much more reliable than self-report. So all this goes into the big picture in terms of the relationships between people and how, whether or not we even realize it, the interaction between ourselves and others can be a very motivating experience. Now, I was feeling pretty down today. And now that I've had this conversation with you, I feel much better. And that's because you're giving me the opportunity to express how I feel and how I think. So, and please don't take this the wrong way, but in this kind of role, you're kind of acting like the student and I'm kind of acting like the professor. But in fact, you are the person that is stimulating my motivation, whether you realize it or not.
Right back at you. You know, before we got on, we kind of shared in common about our legacies and some of the things that we want to honor those that are no longer with us and keep doing the job that you're doing, Dr. Hoffman, because your students, their parents, all the years of learning that you've been able to pour have all went to good, and people are making use and sense of that. No matter if it's 1.2 million or 1.9 million, you are really reaching places. And I'm really thankful that we got a chance to meet. Before we let you go, tell us a little bit about what's next for you and probably what is still left about motivation that you still want to explore.
Well, there's a couple of things. The neuropsychology business and understanding how the brain works related to motivation is still a very much developing field. So probably from a scholarly perspective, I just wrote an article called the Neuropsychology of Belief Change. So I will continue on a scholarly basis to see how brain functioning influences motivation, and specifically the differences between intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. But that's a very much evolving field. So what does that mean to the folks that are probably listening? It means that once we know more about what's happening inside, then I can convert those strategies, that information, into strategies that people can use on an actionable basis. So although many of the strategies I describe in my current book, I didn't invent them all. I did a nice job of interpreting and collecting them. But again, smarter people than me have done some of this research, and I'm the vehicle for making it useful and for being able to apply it. So I think I'm going to the next book, and this is just me keeping myself occupied. Next book is after The Passion and Paradox, and really focusing 100% on the strategies without having to make the argument that the neuropsychology of motivation actually is a meaningful thing. So I'm much more focused on the applied and practical aspects, and that'll be evident in after The Paradox of Passion.
Looking forward to it. You know, friends, each day is a fresh opportunity to begin again. Forgetting the past isn't always what we plan, and it's not easy, as you heard today. But remember, every moment that came before this was also created by you. The real question is, what new memories will you create today? Don't dwell on yesterday. Don't stress about tomorrow, because today is your day. It's a chance to step into the best version of yourself. And today we get to witness a new expression of that greatness, one we've never seen before, but it will be one that no one will ever forget. Don't let anyone step into your dreams with their nightmares. Because on this platform it was built. Because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels the need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. Dr. Hoffman, thank you so much for such a fascinating conversation. Such a pleasure meeting you tonight.
You are the king, Jules. It was a great interview, and I really enjoyed it. And like I said, you made me feel better.
You did that to me too, my friend. Thank you so much.
All right.
See you soon.
Have a great...
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa. This is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde de la Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, mamá. Te extraño mucho.